KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I'm at this press screening. A journalist comes running up to me, shows me her mobile phone, and says, "Your film has just been banned, and there's a warrant out for your arrest."
Director Leslie Udwin was in India as a court blocked the broadcast of her documentary about an infamous gang rape and murder in that country. She wasn't arrested, but her film, India's Daughter, remains banned in India to this day. She tells us about putting herself at risk and in debt to make the film. But first on the News Banter, SNL gets blowback for booking Trump as host, Supergirl flies, and the latest Bond movie looks like a hit, but a very expensive one. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hello there.
So, CNBC had its best night ever because of the Republican debate. We're going to guess that Donald Trump had something to do with that, maybe the presence of Trump. He's fading a bit in Iowa as we record, but he certainly seems not to be fading in the ratings.
Yeah, I'm surprised 14 million people were able to find CNBC on their cable dial.
That is a lot. So the controversy now is that Trump is scheduled to host Saturday Night Live on November 7th. This has kicked off protests, initially by a group called the National Hispanic Leadership Agenda, which has 40 Hispanic organizations in its membership, and that's been followed by other protests. Of course, what they're complaining about are Trump's remarks about Mexican immigrants. They're saying that by allowing him to host the show, that is legitimating and validating, that's their language, his anti-Latino sentiments. And others have joined in. Trump, however, has said they won't back down, and he's in, and he's going to make it a rating smash. Typical modesty.
Yeah, I actually agree with him. I think that there's no way.
When he's right, he's right, right?
Mark this down. There's no way NBC's going to back down here. It's interesting because people might say, well, Donald Trump is ubiquitous in media. Why is Saturday Night Live such a big deal? He's everywhere. But there is a distinction, especially under the FCC law, between entertainment programming and news programming. And, you know, Donald Trump has been on the Today Show. He's been on Meet the Press. He's been on CNBC. He's been on all these different NBC outlets.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out which one the Today Show is, but do go on.
Yeah, it depends on what hour you're watching. But
right.
An explicitly entertainment program like SNL falls outside of that news exception. So the equal time law applies, meaning other candidates can ask stations to give them equal time on their airwaves. And they have about a week after the broadcast to request that time. I don't know if they're going to or if they're just going to kind of let it slide. But it is a big deal that SNL is giving Trump this hour and a half platform to essentially make his case to voters and make himself a more palatable candidate.
Yeah, and you know, Saturday Night Live doesn't have the best track record on diversity issues, so it's a little bit of an embarrassment, or a lot, if you consider that I think we can think of one Hispanic cast member that we can both think of right now that has been
Horatio Sanz was on the show for many years, and you know, they had a whole brouhaha a couple of years ago because they did not have a black female cast member, and there was a whole petition. Now they have two, and they've made some strides in that area, but SNL has historically been a white and kind of, Harvard Lampoon style comedy show. And they are now in this firestorm over diversity and Trump's comments.
Yeah. So we're going to guess they won't back down, and we'll see whether Trump, in fact, delivers the ratings. He's saying if they want to do a show with a third of the ratings, they could drop him. So we'll see. Meanwhile, speaking of good ratings, Supergirl, CBS launched Supergirl, which is a DC Comics property, which Warner Brothers, is, of course, has great interest in, one of their heroes, along with Batman and others. Supergirl is not just super from Warner Brothers' point of view in terms of DC Comics TV, but it's super for CBS and the networks generally, the broadcast networks, because they have launched a very generally bad fall season, and everybody's gasping and panting for some new show to really break through.
Yeah, this is really the first kind of big broadcast hit of the season, and it comes at the tail end of all of the debuts. It's also interesting, you know, everyone has been kind of cynical about this proliferation of superhero shows on television. You know, they're all over the movies, and then, you know, they're all over TV now with Gotham and with, you know, iZombie on the CW, and with, you know, every network has their version of a superhero show, and the Marvel stuff on ABC. But then you see now why they do it. There was a lot of initial tune-in for Supergirl because it's a very well-known property, and the reviews were actually pretty good.
Yeah, the execution apparently is very good. I haven't caught it yet, but 13 million viewers did in the first night alone, and that's a 3.1 rating, and that's a lot in today's landscape, especially, as I said, with these shows not doing well. Speaking also, and not of a superhero, but someone who essentially is kind of indestructible, James Bond, there's been a lot of talk in the business about the gigantic budget of the new upcoming film Spectre, which is opening as we speak in Britain, and the numbers in Britain look like they're on track to be record smashing. So the appetite appears to be there. But this one was, as I said, very, very expensive.
Yeah, some of the documents revealed in the Sony hack suggested that the budget had ballooned past $300 million. One of the executives lamented that this could be the most expensive movie of all time. Since then, the studio has said that due to partnerships and tax incentives and product placement, the budget is in the $250 million range.
Oh, what a bargain.
Yeah, even if you believe that, that's still pretty expensive. And there was one Sony email where the head of business affairs said that even if the film does $1.1 billion, which is what Skyfall did a few years ago, that the studio, Sony, via its arrangement with MGM and the family that controls the property, would only realize about $30-something million dollars in profit. So that's a gigantic bet and a huge expenditure for potentially not that much money for Sony.
Yeah, I mean, I know in the past they had spent in excess of $100 million on marketing alone. So it is a very expensive proposition, and it's not clear whether Sony will continue to be in the Bond business after this movie, right?
Yeah, the deal for Sony to distribute the Bond films, which is made with MGM, which controls the property with the Broccoli family, which has the rights to the Bond franchise. I know this is all confusing, but that deal ends after this movie. So there's a lot of speculation as to whether another studio will come in and try to steal Bond, essentially, away from Sony, or whether Sony, and, you know, by all accounts, the relationship with the family and with MGM is a good one. And the last Bond was the highest grossing Bond of all time with $1.1 billion. So there's a lot of incentives to keep the same team in place, but I think they're all going to look at how this film does, specifically because it costs so much, and then make a determination after this film opens whether the franchise will stay or move on.
And of course, there's a new regime at Sony, and there'll be a new Bond, apparently, because Daniel Craig said he would rather cut his wrists than do it again. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. The documentary India's Daughter focuses on the horrifying rape and murder of medical student Jyoti Singh in December 2012 and the vocal public reaction to the crime.
The brutal gang rape of a 23-year-old girl on her way home from a movie triggered an awakening that took many by surprise.
Televised reports of those protests, which turned violent when authorities responded with tear gas and water cannons, transfixed British filmmaker Leslie Udwin. She had never directed a movie before, but she was an experienced TV and film producer who had spent some time in India. So Udwin set out to make a film about this incident that shocked the world. She went to India, where she interviewed the victim's parents as well as the families of some of the men convicted of the assault. But the most controversial aspect of her film, India's Daughter, was an extended interview with one of the rapists, now in prison and sentenced to death. That man's view of the crime was that the rape was the victim's fault because she was out at night. One of his lawyers, M.L. Sharma, was also interviewed for the film.
Girl or woman are more precious than a gem, than a diamond. If you put your diamond on the street, certainly the dog will take it out.
India's Daughter has been screened on TV stations and in movie theaters around the world, but it's banned to this day in India. A court in that country blocked the broadcast just days before its air date last March. Udwin, who was in India at the time, blames ads that had been created by Indian station NDTV to promote the film.
What it did was choose the very disturbing and, one might say, sensationalist comments without context of the rapist. And one understands why they did this, because their job is to get attention.
The Indian broadcaster showed these trailers for your film, and then it became a court matter somehow.
Yes, the Home Minister went to a magistrate the night of the day the trails were shown and asked for a stay, a ban to be put on the film. And I was actually sent the text that he presented to the magistrate in order to persuade him to ban it. And it was that they feared that the broadcast of the film would lead to a disruption in law and order.
Of course, they'd had riots in the wake of the attack.
Yes. Well, actually, to be more accurate, they'd had peaceful, beautiful protests. Right. They turned into riots because the government, in its misguided feeling of being threatened,
right,
cracked down on the protesters, so they became violent. But of course, the truth soon came out in, you know, the Lok Sabha, which is the Indian parliament. The morning after the ban, I was in Delhi watching these hysterical MPs screaming about a conspiracy of shame that I had intended to bring on India and how I was going to decimate their tourist industry. So that, I guess, was the real concern. I have to tell you that on the Sunday when NDTV were due to broadcast, they protested against the ban in the most heroic fashion between 9 p.m. and 10 p.m., which is exactly when the film would have broadcast. They ran a black screen. They're a commercial TV station. This was so heroic.
As a protest, they ran a black screen.
They did.
Now, you've lived in Israel and South Africa and Britain. What did you know about India when you started this project?
I had lived in India for 6 months. I had made a film there. My very first feature film ever was East is East. And I had been going back and forth to India for some 14 years since East is East. It's a country that I've had a very close and strong relationship with. Of course, I'm not steeped in the culture. I don't have a direct relationship, which is one of the things that, you know, has so irked the trolls in India. And indeed, I have to tell you, the feminists in India. When I say the feminists, there's a core of 20 really respected feminists there who I have recently learned called for the ban.
Wow, that's shocking
as that is.
That does surprise me, because you are not from India.
For a number of reasons, they complained about the fact that the word daughter is in the title.
Because I mean, it sounds like not an independent woman, but a daughter.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. They say that's the language of patriarchy.
Right.
And my answer to that is pathetic semantics. Patriarchy doesn't own language. Don't grace patriarchy with ownership of our language. I'm a daughter. I have a daughter. It's a perfectly respectable word. And a daughter should be treated with love, with respect. And this daughter of India, as are other daughters in the world, was not and are not.
So you hear of this assault, this terrible story, which was global news, and you say to yourself, I want to make a documentary about this, even though it was a new form for you.
Because I have made campaigning films in the past, as a producer, I have tasted and felt the thrill of a film making a difference. So I'm standing in my kitchen 2 weeks before this news breaks on television with my husband cutting vegetables. I literally, you know, just out of nowhere, I guess, just said, you know, I'm yearning to do that again. The last couple of films I've made haven't really moved the world on in any particular palpable way, and I want to do that. Forgot about that conversation. Then up comes this news erupting across the screens all over Europe and the world of this horrific gang rape. Penny doesn't drop at that stage. It's when I saw the protests. I was awestruck. I just thought this is humanity at its best. These men and women of India, across all classes and, you know, all genders, came out day after day for over a month. And I just thought, I have to go and join that. And my way of joining it, of course, because I'm a filmmaker, is to make a film. Now, I wouldn't have directed it if I'd been funded. But I went just with fire in my belly and whatever money I could grab together of my family savings.
Wow.
I had to direct it because I couldn't afford to hire a director.
Did you attempt to get the funding or did you just want to go?
No, I didn't have time. I just wanted to go. It was urgent. I had to make it almost immediately. What I did do, though, was research very thoroughly before I left. I had to know which doors to knock on. I had to get addresses. I had to know what I was going to ask those rapists, because for me, interviewing the rapists was a sine qua non. It was absolutely paramount. And I venture to say, if I had got a no from the prison authorities, who I wrote an impassioned letter to, I'm not sure I would actually have made the film.
I'm actually surprised you got a yes.
So is everyone. But, you know, I think people are reluctant to ask sometimes because they think the answer's going to be no. And I did spend a long time on that letter. I wrote it and rewrote it for a week and made it the most impassioned plea I could. And I think also, to be fair, the fact that she was a woman, the director general, which is quite unusual in itself, of Delhi prisons, I think that helped her say yes.
I mean, did you make it clear that you felt there was a political message that was imperative to?
Oh, yes. I said, this is a campaigning film. I am making this film because I have been so moved by these protests. Everything that I say now about the film is exactly what I felt then, and that's what I expressed in that letter.
And she said yes. And how did you crew up in India?
I grabbed anyone and everyone I could. There was no continuity on this crew. I mean, I think it's miraculous that this film coheres. There are days when I look at it and think, how on earth have I achieved this? Because I didn't have a DOP right through.
A cinematographer.
I had three. It was a technical mess when we got to the editing room. I mean, everything and anything that could have gone wrong went wrong. And I'm amazed because I'm immensely proud of it. I think it is, it's a very cohesive, very compelling piece of work. And I just wanted the direct participants in the story to speak for themselves.
So you get to the prison and they say, come on in and here's our rapists and...
Yeah, it wasn't quite as simple as that. I mean, yeah, they did say, come on in. There were certain conditions. I could only interview the rapists in this case after they'd been convicted. And when I started filming, they were still not convicted. And I then decided to practice on four other rapists.
Oh, that must have been interesting for you.
I mean, the insights I got on that, one of those four had raped a five-year-old girl. And I sat with him for 3 hours.
I can't imagine how you didn't, you know, like lunge.
Well, I'll tell you, that was a real shock to me. The whole process was one of reversal of expectations. I was sure I'd lunge. I was so sure. In fact, that's one of the reasons I decided to practice. When I was 18, Kim, I was raped. I'm ashamed to tell you that I kept it to myself for 20 years. My husband's the first person I told. And I didn't report him. I'm so ashamed of that. If I could only turn back the clock.
You might give yourself a break on that because
different
times and different worlds.
Different times, all of that. But, you know, now I'm so immersed in this issue and here I am, you know, encouraging women to talk and report and speak up. And that's why I do, by the way. That's why I feel I must tell people that I was raped. And I thought that these demons lurking beneath the surface were bound to explode in me when I sat across from rapists. If I tell you, I did not feel one second of anger in 31 hours of interviewing these men. And you know why I didn't?
No.
Because they're not the monsters that I prepared myself to meet. That's the most chilling thing I have to tell you. They're really ordinary, normal men. They're programmed. They are taught how to think of women.
Coming up after a short break, Udwin says she ignored the advice of 7 different lawyers who told her to flee India after her film was banned. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
D Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW Radio.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to filmmaker Leslie Udwin, whose documentary, India's Daughter, focuses on the brutal rape and murder of 23-year-old medical student Jyoti Singh. The film is banned in India, but it has aired elsewhere, including on the BBC in the UK. It will run on the PBS show Independent Lens in the US on November 16th, and it's playing in theaters in New York and LA. In making India's Daughter, Udwin encountered myriad problems, including a perpetual shortage of cash. But nothing prepared her for a Delhi court's decision to ban her film before it aired in India.
Everyone knew what we were doing, and there was no resistance at all until the ban. And Kim, you could have knocked me over with a stick.
With the ban.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, the government had it like turned hoses on the demonstrators. You knew there was going to be maybe...
But why ban this film? Prime Minister Modi on Independence Day, before this film came out, said to his people, when we consider the issue of rape in our country, we should hang our heads in shame. I mean, it's his values that are reflected in this film. You know, I certainly didn't expect him to ban it, well, you know, or his home minister to ban it.
There was also an allegation that you paid for an interview of one of the rapists. I don't even know where, I'm not sure where that came from, but that's sort of...
The lawyer, M.L. Sharma, he made two allegations.
One is that I paid the
rapist, and the other was that I gave him a script to learn.
Oh. Okay.
There was a prison guard present through every single minute of 16 hours of interview with Mukesh. And what, did he not think a camera was running on Mukesh going, oh, I forgot that line. Sorry, can I start again, please? Can we cut, please? I mean, honestly, how pathetic the lies, the attempts to discredit me. It's all about resistance to the message. Shoot the messenger, get her by any means.
This was his lawyer.
His lawyer, M.L. Sharma.
He's one of the lawyers on camera talking about how
he is
inappropriate it was for this poor young woman to be
out at night, going to a movie, Life of Pi, absolutely monstrous.
She went to see Life of Pi, yeah.
My God.
So when the ban, when the film is meant to be broadcast in India and the ban happened, apparently you were advised that you were going to potentially be arrested.
Yes.
Told to leave the country, possibly for your own sake.
I'm at this press screening. A journalist comes running up to me, shows me her mobile phone and says, your film has just been banned and there's a warrant out for your arrest. And so I call these lawyers. Every single one of the first six say to me, stop talking to me on the phone, just go, leave now, go to the airport and get on the plane. And I didn't want to go. Everything in me thought, I've done nothing wrong. I'm not going to flee. I'm not going to go. And I had another 24, 26 hours, something like that, before the flight I'd originally booked on was to leave. So I phoned the seventh lawyer thinking, well, he'll tell me it's okay. You're a British citizen. The British embassy will protect you. And I said, look, six lawyers have now told me, get on a plane and flee immediately. He said, no, whatever you do, don't do that. I thought, thank God, someone with, you know, a bit of courage here. He said, drive to Nepal and get the first plane out of Nepal because they'll be waiting for you.
Right. I'll find you there. Go the other way.
I didn't go.
You didn't
I stuck
go.
It out. I didn't tell my family because they would have forced me home. And they came for me holding my picture half an hour after I left for the airport.
What would they have done with you, though, really?
Arrested me. They would have arrested me and given me
and
a very
hard
time.
And then there would have been a tremendous outcry from...
Hopefully.
Had the BBC come in yet with to
yes,
participate?
They had.
So it
yes,
would have been
had.
A thing with the BBC.
Yes.
I can see it in my head.
I can see it too.
I've seen this movie in my head.
But it would have taken time, you know.
Yeah, sure. Well, so, okay, you don't leave. The film doesn't play. And this blowback has been tremendous.
Yeah.
So the rape, the showing, with the inclusion of the interviews with the rapists has been, there's been controversy to some degree. Why are you giving them a forum? I assume that you would give them a forum because how would anybody have any understanding of this issue if they don't have a forum?
100%. And it's not like they're being given a one-man show, you know? And that's why I say it may have been a mistake in retrospect to simply put out the trails of the rapists' views
yes,
in that way.
Yes, which might have been provocative.
Which might have been provocative. But in the film, it's far from that.
So if the BBC was involved at that point, did they try to go to bat for the picture at all and have the film shown in India or persuade anything?
No, but then that's not within their ambit. What they did do was strenuously resist the naive calls of the Indian government, and they did try very hard to prevent the BBC from screening the film. They asked the countries that were going to show the film that Sunday not to show it. And of course, the BBC said, you cannot tell a democratic country to be undemocratic in order to support an unconstitutional and undemocratic ban that you are imposing on your own country. And they did bring the broadcast forward because I think they wanted to stop it becoming a political international incident, and they wanted focus to be on the film.
So they just went ahead and broadcast it earlier than intended.
They did. And I didn't even know they were doing that because they did it on the night I was flying back from Delhi to London.
Oh, you missed your TV film.
I missed my TV, yeah.
Well, so wrong.
It had been on in the cinemas the week before.
So. Okay, so you knew what it was in it. You knew what it was.
I knew what was in it.
The plot, yeah. I understand you did go into debt.
I'm still in debt.
You used your own money, and you're not supposed to use your own money. You know that rule.
I know that. And in this case, I would have given absolutely everything. I mean, I did. Thank God for East is East is all I can say. I mean, that film did really well, okay? It won a BAFTA award, and it did really good business and good box office around the world. So I did have a nest egg of family savings, which I went through with alarming
alacrity. Speed, yes.
So that's all gone. I'm still carrying a debt of £117,000 on the film and probably about another £60,000 on the campaign because I can't stop. I am compelled. And there is one tutor that I have denied my daughter because I just can't afford it until we get some money in. And we will. But my God, in the documentary world, it's a nightmare.
So you've been through a fair bit. You know, you've been, your partner turned on you.
Yes.
There have been these allegations. You might have potentially been arrested in India. Would you do it again?
100%. And I'll tell you why I would do it again, for two reasons. On a personal level, because we all have to have some approbation, some affirmation of what we've done. I would do it all over again now and double up the pain of it.
Beware.
I will send a photograph. I've been so sad that those amazing voices that took me to India that I so admired have been silent, that they've fallen into apathy again. And there was this little four-year-old who was raped last weekend and died as a result. Finally, a demonstration comes out onto the streets that I've been hoping for, waiting for all these, well, 2 years, really. And there are three wonderful women in this picture with a whole group behind them. It's not a massive demonstration, but maybe, you know, a couple of hundred people. And the first placard says, "Don't teach us what to wear, teach your sons not to rape." And the second placard says, "Thank you, Leslie Udwin." And I just wept, and I'm so moved by that. I mean, for me, that's what it's about, to reach hearts and minds and to transform them and to give hope and to make change. And we all need to stand together and do that.
Leslie Udwin is the director of India's Daughter. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. I'm very, very grateful.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Grant Buckerfield. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu. Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.